The Guardian.
Hello there, I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this is Politics Weekly Extra, or US Politics Weekly, as we've been calling it. Earlier in the week, I hosted a Guardian Live event with colleagues from our Guardian US team, where we looked at the latest state of play in the US presidential election. I was joined by the senior political reporters Daniel Strauss and Lauren Gambino, and also Guardian US columnist Richard Wolff. We discuss everything from tonight's presidential debate to the states we need to be focusing on in these last few days before Election Day on the 3rd of November. I hope you enjoy it. I wanted to kick off, I'm going to avoid the risk of treating this like some kind of therapy session, but it may become that. And that is to say, a question to all three of you that has come to me a few times, which is, tell me the truth, is your gut instinct that Joe Biden actually has this election in the bag, and the only thing preventing you saying that is some kind of superstition stroke post-traumatic stress disorder inflicted by what happened in 2016 that has made all journalists fearful of making any predictions, even to themselves, in the quiet of the night? I'm seeing you smiling there, Lauren Gambino, as if you are a kindred spirit on this. Tell me the truth. Do you privately think Biden's the winner, but you're still in the grip of what happened in 2016?
Can I caveat my answer by saying on election night 2016, I was in the Javits Center waiting for Hillary Clinton to come out. As the night went on, little girls dressed up in pantsuits were crying tears. It was traumatic just to be in that sort of environment. So that's my memory of 4 years ago. So I honestly don't think anything is over till it's over. But I will say the two elections are different. And this does seem like Biden has had a steadier lead for a longer amount of time. So at the risk of being very, very wrong again, it does seem like Biden's in a good place.
And Daniel, people can, as I say, they can rob me of several hours of night's sleep by showing me projections and polling from exactly this point out in 2016. 2 weeks out in 2016, I think, the now notorious Nate Silver sort of projection gave Hillary Clinton a 91% probability of winning. Even when you look at those battleground polling, the crucial states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, yes, Joe Biden is ahead in those states now, but people can find the slides that show you Hillary Clinton was ahead by pretty similar amounts in 2016. So where are you on this question of gut instinct and post-traumatic stress from 2016?
Well, I actually try and stay away from the prediction business in my professional life. But, those discussions always lead into questions about how similar this race is to 2016. And it's not. Joe Biden's lead over Donald Trump has been incredibly static, despite a range of news events that you would expect would append the race. And they haven't. And then beyond that, pollsters, have figured out have recalibrated how they poll and to factor in what they missed in 2016. And we know that's been pretty effective because they were, to a greater extent than 2016, on the ball in 2018. And finally, beyond that, Joe Biden is not Hillary Clinton. Joe Biden has not been the target of a multi-decade assault by conservative media. And I think that's all going to play a difference. But does that mean that a candidate is a favorite? No. Anyone who says any election is a sure thing just doesn't understand how elections work. There's always a chance. There are always persuadable voters. Right now, it does appear that Joe Biden is the heavy favorite, but we won't know until Election Day.
And we may not even know on Election Day. We're going to come back to that later. But and I think very wise to be out of the predictions business. Before we go to Richard, I just want to follow up one thing you said, because I thought it was particularly interesting. You made this point about the static nature of Joe Biden's lead. Now, it's been rock solid, really, going back into 2019. It hasn't really varied. For people making the contrast with 2016, was that not the case with Hillary Clinton? Did her lead sort of yo-yo up and down?
Right. It was not the case. Her Her lead was bigger at moments. It expanded and contracted. And Clinton herself has said that their internals showed that the needle moved away from her favor after the Comey letter, which I think was about a year and a, or 4 years and a week or two ago from where we are now. So, I mean, it's just different. And the other thing to factor into that is that the Biden campaign is paying far more attention to the Midwestern states that Hillary Clinton took for granted than the Clinton campaign.
So, Richard, let's come to you. You and I have known each other a long time. I am, by nature, when it comes to elections, a worrier. And, you know, in the manner of the sort of therapeutic session I'm hoping for here, see if you can reassure me. There are many, many, many indicators, and Daniel and Lauren have said many of them, that suggest that Biden is pretty comfortable. Nevertheless, there are a few of these little straws in the wind. You know, Thomas Edsel, very good political reporter in the New York Times, had some data showing that voter new registrations in crucial places like Pennsylvania, Republicans were outnumbering the new voters. I just read something from Ron Brownstein, another very good reporter out of Wisconsin, saying that they're noticing that in the really heavy Trump areas, rural counties particularly, that electorate that is solely for Trump is getting even bigger. There's a lot of enthusiasm. They're voting early. And that by comparison, people of color, black voters, not voting in the proportions they would need to. Now, tell me if I'm wrong, or are these just outlying facts, and the bulk of the facts point in the other direction?
Well, I think at this point of an election, you can pick and choose your anecdotal data to confirm whatever narrative you like. I do think it's worth looking back at 2016 and understanding what happened then, especially at this point of the cycle. As Daniel mentioned, the Comey events of the final weekend really led to a collapse of the late-breaking voters against Hillary Clinton. And we've seen that gambit happening now with this purported laptop that mysteriously passed through Steve Bannon and Rudy Giuliani's hands into a weird computer repair shop. It's not penetrating because the whole Trump show has lost its ability to grab attention. So
just give us the 10-second summary of what that story is, because it may not have reached people here. Why don't you just bring us up to date on what that is?
Well, to the extent that I want to repeat the disinformation, I will summarize it and try and make sense of it. A laptop that is purported to have come from Hunter Biden, not the candidate, but the candidate's son, is supposed to have emerged with emails revealing some hint of a meeting that Hunter arranged for his father, then Vice President Joe Biden. And that's about it. So, you know, this has been obviously heavily disputed from the Biden campaign. And then they have refused to answer further questions because, of course, the discussion spreads the disinformation. And that has been taken among people who want to spread the disinformation that it's, well, they're refusing to engage. They're refusing to answer questions. This, by the way, is a story that the New York Post writers have refused to put their name to, and Fox News itself refused to publish on its own website, but doesn't seem to mind talking about it endlessly. All I'm saying is that we've had the supposed late-breaking bombshell, and it's not working. And it's not working in large measure because there wasn't that decades of trashing of character that Hillary Clinton suffered for Joe Biden. He's cracked 50 points in the poll, which is a psychological measure, but it also tells you that the electorate has decided about him and about, in particular, about Trump. So fewer persuadable late-breaking voters. And in addition to all that, 2016 really hinged on a fluke in the Electoral College. So can you imagine losing an election by 2 or 3 points, which is what Trump did, and still winning in the Electoral College? Until 2016, that had never happened before. This time around, he's in a worse position. Trump is in a worse position than he was in 2016 by every single measure. So it's not in the bag, but every single data point, regardless of registrations and everything else that you want, turnout, every single data point points to a much stronger position for Joe Biden, to the point where he could collapse in the polls, just as Hillary Clinton did, lose 2 or 3 points, and he'd still be 5 points ahead, at least on those national averages, which we can debate whether or not they're meaningful.
What could still go wrong? And I don't mean, I'm not asking you to sort of, you know, imagine asteroids hitting Earth sort of thing, but just in the way that the race is still got to play out, we've got a debate coming up. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But what else, Lauren, is still in this race that has not yet played out?
When I asked someone about this a couple months ago, there are the biggest things that could have happened is one of the candidates get coronavirus and Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. So we have blown through these predictions of the craziest things that could happen this cycle. I guess it's still possible Joe Biden could get coronavirus. I mean, the pandemic is still very real. It could actually flare in a state, and you know, we're seeing it flare in Wisconsin and in other states where turnout will probably determine the result there. So I think probably the pandemic and how that plays out would be a big one for me. I mean, we're already seeing early voting, you know, reach record numbers. And so that kind of puts at least some numbers in the bag. We're obviously, you know, some of the returns have looked good for Democrats. That doesn't mean that, you know, they're suddenly far outpacing Republicans. It could just mean that Democrats who are just choosing to vote earlier because they believe that's the more responsible approach, or they're worried about postal voting. But nonetheless, that is, you know, those votes are sealed, they're done, you know, and now Democrats can focus on other areas of the country where they need to turn out people. So, it's just an interesting race because there's so many people who've already voted at this point that whatever happens in the next 2 weeks, it will have a diminishing effect on the race because so many people have already voted.
Richard, I saw you nodding there.
Yes, look, I think turnout is high on both sides. You should expect, I mean, this is the nature of Trump. Everyone he motivates to the polls for himself, he motivates on the other side against him. So he's a living, breathing zero-sum game, coughing zero-sum game. Joe Biden getting coronavirus, obviously, I think, to be honest, would be a challenge to his personal health and therefore, you know, the campaign in general. But in terms of a shock to the system, look, we've got a debate this week. That's the last roll of the dice for the Trump campaign. And given the rules that have just emerged today about muting his microphone, he's got actually one less tool in the toolbox to try and disrupt Joe Biden. The last debate that they had, obviously they skipped one, you know, the polling afterwards was really disastrously bad for Trump. Now, it was mixed up with his own COVID infection, and so it's hard to sort of pull those two things apart. But there's no sign that Donald Trump, who by all reports is not actually doing any debate prep, is best placed to move the needle with this week's debate either. But that's the last unpredictable element that you can imagine now.
Since we're there now, Richard's taken us there onto the debate. Daniel, what do you think could actually be game-changing by either of them? And I'm just interested on the mute button question, because how does that play? Who does that help?
I mean, the mute button is only limited in its efficacy because it's for the opening 2-minute statements. And then anytime another candidate interrupts the other, they gain the interrupted candidate gains time, which I was a little surprised about. I thought the commission in charge of organizing and setting the rules for these debates would apply a stronger set of rules for this to stop interruptions like last time. There's not much for Trump to gain out of this if we assume that his personality will stay the same as last time. So the way that Trump could conceivably, I think it's very unlikely to happen, conceivably gain from this debate is that he came off as an entirely different kind of candidate, one who's very calm and considerate and concise and truthful in his answers. I mean, and that's not unheard of for a candidate to present himself as a very conservative figure and then come on stage as more of a moderate. That's what Mitt Romney did in 2012. I don't think that's going to happen here. What does Joe Biden have to do? Just the same thing as last time, if these polls are to be trusted. Just be composed, take the hits when he has to, and address the American people more than Trump. Right now, what really plays against Trump is like any of these attacks, which he prefers, that remind Americans of the humanity of Joe Biden.
Just Laurie, on this business with the mute button, and I am aware that I'm sounding slightly obsessed with this button. What I picked up was that some people thought it would help Trump, partly because it would save him from himself. Because as Daniel says, it's only during those opening 2 minutes, but at least it means he can't be heard interrupting. And then there is this other idea, which the Trump people are saying, which is, oh, this will be great because now Biden will have to fill a whole 2 minutes, and who knows, he may lose his train of thought. And this was a point Trump himself made, saying he'll lose his train of thought, you know, and as he was making the point, Trump himself lost his train of thought and didn't get to the end of the sentence. But you saw the point he was making, that actually 2 minutes uninterrupted might even be damaging for Joe Biden. What do you think?
That's a case that they've been trying to make pretty much all cycle. And, you know, Trump supporters do believe Biden has dementia, that Biden is slow, that Biden is, you know, lost his fastball is the quote the campaign likes to use. But when you see Biden up close, like Daniel and I both cover the campaign, so we've both been out with him. I mean, this man can speak for 2 minutes. He will be fine. I don't think there's that risk. You know, both Trump and Biden have a tendency to ramble. I think that's just their approach. You know, Biden gets lost in train of thought. You know, he will quote scripture, quote Kierkegaard, loves to quote Kierkegaard, but you know, he does get lost in himself. But I think that's more, I mean, Biden's always been like that, and that's how he was as a vice president and as a senator. So of course, there's the possibility that, you know, 2 minutes he veers off script, but you know, also Trump does that as well. And you know, as far as it helping Trump, possibly in those first 2 minutes, but I can't imagine we go a whole debate without Trump sort of jumping in and wanting to get the better of Biden. And, you know, similarly, it could also be a really bad image if you just see Trump sort of flapping around and you can't hear what he's saying. So, you know, that would probably be an easy ad for the Biden campaign to cut.
On this business about that we started with, on the poll lead, some people have, you know, think that, okay, yeah, sure, it's showing sometimes double-digit poll margins, but the nature of the American electoral system is such that you almost have to, you know, that is discount 5 or 6 points because of all the things that stand in the way of Democrats voting. And I'm thinking of the voter suppression efforts that actually disenfranchise so many voters, particularly poorer voters and people of color. We've been following here even the amazing saga of the mailbox in Harris County, Texas. Only one drop-off box for early voting for 4.7 million people. And so I look at those polls when it says Biden 50, Trump 40. I think, well, in effect, that's 45, 41. You know, it's much closer because so many Democratic votes are never actually going to register. Am I overly sort of overdoing that, Richard?
No, although I think the numbers are slightly different. When I was working at NBC, we actually set our political team of, each broadcaster has a team of essentially political scientists and number crunchers who call the elections. So they're modeling out the electorate at every cycle so that they can announce the results before they're actually counted. And our political team, it was a midterm year, and they said, look, given voter suppression, given gerrymandering, in this congressional election, our calculation is that Democrats need to win by 3 points just to get to parity in congressional results. So there is a tilt in the structure of many of these places. It's variable because each state controls the election apparatus and to a large degree, the rules. I think if you look at the states that really matter, that mattered last time to Trump winning in the Electoral College, you start looking at the individual state polls in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and then in another tier around places like Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona. And what you see there is this really significant swing from where Clinton was to where Biden is. And that swing is, you know, 8, 9, 10 points. Even in a place like Florida, where the margins are really tight, you can look at a county, because the polling now at the state level is much better than it was 4 years ago. A county like Pinellas County, which is the St. Petersburg area out west, and there you're looking at an 8 to 10 point swing towards Biden from where Trump was. When you get those kinds of movements, I think that even a really organized effort to suppress the vote and limit voting and have fewer voting places, it collapses. It's just too big a wave to overcome. So we've had lots of you know, apocalyptic stories about delayed results and legal challenges. When you get this many states in play, if these polling numbers match up to where the results come out, I don't think it'll matter.
It does look right now like, because we are already seeing a wave of voting that breaks sort of expectations, it's unclear if that's going to matter. But, you know, one consequence of this, though, is that it creates legal challenges, which is something that both campaigns have had in the back of their minds. There's been a lot of speculation that if Donald Trump doesn't win this election, or if it is close, that we will spend weeks, maybe even months, going through legal challenges, sort of like the 2000 election where Florida became the decider, except in multiple states, over who, which ballots should be counted, which were returned incorrectly. And that could sway the election. I personally am actually doubtful that that's going to happen. There are multiple states where if Joe Biden wins them on election night, it's very unlikely that not conceding on election night will be fruitful for Donald Trump at all. States like Ohio, for instance. But it's a possibility. And more so than in other elections I've covered, the requirements for voting is playing an outsized role right now.
I mean, Lauren, because what Daniel speaks to there is this notion that people have been talking about, particularly in the media as well, not just political campaigns, the so-called red mirage, that there is kind of one appearance on the election day of results of people who voted that day. And then in the days that follow, the so-called blue drift, as actually you count up the votes that arrive by post and they then tilt you back towards the Democrats. Are you, is that still an issue? Or are you kind of with Richard that if this wave is so big, actually all these sort of things that we've been spending a lot of energy on, in the way they're sort of washed away by the wave?
I mean, certainly if Biden does exceptionally well, you know, then a lot of these problems sort of do resolve themselves. And I think it becomes much harder to challenge the results, either, by refusing to concede or through legal challenges. But, you know, I do think that there's plenty of reasons. And it's actually, you know, we've talked about it as, you know, as reporters, like, it's our job to tell people that, you know, especially given the volume of voting by mail this cycle, we need to really be prepared for the election to not be called on the night or the morning after, and that it could take time, and people need to just prepare themselves that, you know, the what you first see is often not the final result. And if you're seeing, like, you know, Biden up by a lot and there's only 3% return in Pennsylvania, that doesn't mean a lot, you know, so you have to hold on and watch. But I think also you will have, it looks like you're going to have a decent chunk of Democratic votes in critical states to start with. So I don't know if it'll be sort of a shocking Trump way ahead and then, you know, Democrats come in later with their mail-in ballots, as we've seen. And we saw that even in 2018 and in some Senate races. So we'll see, but so much is up in the air. It's hard to tell at this point.
Yeah, I would just add to this that these new decade votes are really important for electoral maps moving forward. So what's happened, it's census year, and the census count is important and has been subject of all sorts of controversy with the Trump administration. But what happens is that this legislature at the state level that gets elected in these years, so in 2000, 2010, and now 2020, they determine the congressional maps moving forward. They are critical years. If this is a wave election, there is an awful lot of electoral reform that can happen in state houses that the Democrats will use to rebalance things moving forward. Because gerrymandering is actually the most important factor in terms of how things get distorted. And this is a once in a decade chance to correct that, which Democrats didn't actually, because of the cycle and the political dynamics, didn't have the opportunity to do in 2010.
Yeah. And Democrats, by the way, I mean, what's important about this is that governors play active roles in this. And Democrats have a high number of governor's mansions right now, including in usually red states like Kentucky, for instance. That gives them an opportunity to redraw maps for a long time. At the same time, though, there are Republican governors in a swath of eastern states, New England states that are usually Democratic, that will probably shift control a little bit toward Republicans when it comes to redrawing electoral maps there.
Now, there wasn't a break in the live event, but we're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. And in today's episode, you're hearing a discussion between me and three of my colleagues on the Guardian US team on what exactly is happening in this slightly crazy presidential campaign. Lauren, I'm going to put it to you because you told us about the source you had spoke to a while ago who said, look, the two wildcard events that could happen, one would be one of the candidates getting coronavirus and the other would be the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, creating a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And as you told, you know, rightly point out, both those things happened. When Justice Ginsburg died, a lot of people said, well, this is now turning the election on its head. This will now be what the election is about. And here we are in the nomination hearings for Trump's choice to replace Justice Ginsburg, namely Amy Coney Barrett. Those hearings are going on, and they are not, you know, the top story in the news. They are sort of rumbling along. What effect, if any, has this process, or is this process having, on the election? Because it's not clear to me whether it's having some, none, or for which, or who's benefiting. I can see Richard wants to come. Why don't you go first, Lauren? Then I'll come to you, Richard, and maybe Daniel chip in.
So I don't think it was the bombshell we all initially thought it might be. And I think that's for maybe a couple reasons. One is because Brett Kavanaugh was sort of the big fight for Democrats. He was the one who really did shift the balance of the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett will cement the conservative majority on the court, which is no small matter. But at the same time, you know, Democrats were already looking at being in, liberals were looking at being in the minority on the court. And I think there was just not that same fight. And also, obviously, Amy Coney Barrett is not Brett Kavanaugh. There was sexual assault allegations that were brought up during that hearing. It really kind of, I think, just sort of pulled a scab off a nation that was still reeling from Trump's, the allegations against Trump. And it was just a much different climate. And there was also some sort of hope there that they could sway some Republicans on the committee or later in the final vote in the Senate floor. That's just not the same this time around. It's kind of been preordained. The one thing it has done is it's revived this conversation around court packing, which is fairly technical and, you know, was something that was brought up in the Democratic primary, but we haven't really seen it move to mainstream politics. But suddenly now all the candidates, the presidential candidates, Senate candidates are being pressed on, would you want to expand the Supreme Court, add more justices because of, you know, what Democrats view as total injustice by rushing this nomination through. So I think in that sense, it's brought this new issue to light. Biden has not said how he feels about it, which has become an issue that's dogged him. The only benefit I see is maybe for Trump just rallying his base. And he has an entirely base strategy. It's all about exciting the base, turning the base out. I mean, at this point, that seems to be his whole game plan. So possibly this is just a good reminder of, hey, if you weren't going to vote for me this cycle, because you were, you know, remember what I've done on the Supreme Court.
First of all, let me just respectfully disagree with Lauren. I actually think Barrett's position, Barrett's appointment is the game changer on the Supreme Court. You move from a 5-4 court where Chief Justice John Roberts has proved that he is willing to switch sides and vote with more liberal members of the court. And that's why you have a 4-4 tie just now on the Pennsylvania ballot counting decision yesterday. So John Roberts' role there just completely gets wiped out in a 6-3 court with Amy Coney Barrett. The only reason it's not controversial is because Democrats have been very intentional about not making this another Kavanaugh fight, not litigating about her religion and even her lack of judicial qualifications, because she's barely been a judge for a couple of years. Because they know that will motivate the other side and motivate turnout. That's what Kavanaugh did. Motivates on both sides, but they don't want to do anything that motivates the other side. I think it's pretty clear at this point that the Biden campaign is preparing to add people to the court on the basis that Democrats feel that two seats have been stolen. That was the Scalia seat, Merrick Garland's appointment, which the Republicans refused to entertain as a nomination under President Obama, and now this one. So I think it's quite likely that Joe Biden, as much of an institutionalist as he is, takes the court from 9 to 11, and it becomes a 6-5 court, still conservative leaning. And he says that's redressing the balance, but not actually packing the court. You know, the court has changed its composition over time. I think it started out at 6 justices. It's now 9. It's not defined by the Constitution, which is what the Supreme Court is supposed to rule on. It's not defined by the Constitution how many seats there should be. It may take an act of Congress, but you'd be assuming here at this case that Democrats are actually in control of Congress. So in addition to what the president might be able to do by simply nominating someone and using the traditional path, they could have the safety net of having an act of Congress to cement that as well. So I think it's inconceivable that the Supreme Court would stop.
All right, Daniel, I bet you've got views on that, but I just want to make sure we go to some of the things that our readers, viewers, listeners have been coming in with. And they've been, I mean, there's one just tonight about how significant is the Hispanic vote in Florida of Hispanics for Trump? And is that because Republicans have persuaded them that the Democrats are socialists, like they've been left behind in Venezuela and Cuba, etc.? Could they tip Florida Trump? But lots of people have been, especially in advance, have been writing in variations of this question about whether either about Latino voters or about African-American voters, particularly asking this question of kind of how on earth are people of color voting for Donald Trump? And there are these numbers that suggest at least some people in those groups are. And the, you know, the Guardian reader listener is a bit mystified. Can you enlighten them for us, Daniel? Why is this happening?
Because every voter is different, and no party or political movement has a monopoly on any kind of any gender or race or ethnicity. Like, I'm a little weirded out by that question, to be honest. There are going to be African-Americans who vote for Trump. There are going to be Hispanics and Latinos who vote for Trump. There are going to be women who vote for Trump. There are going to be men who vote for Trump. The difference is that they will probably remain a minority. Now, the Trump campaign subtly has tried to court African-Americans, or at least a small swath of them, in the hopes that that could help tip the election. They've done that overtly by touting rather vaguely the president's criminal justice reform legislation, and Trump himself constantly saying he's done more for the African-American community than any president in history, maybe save Lincoln, which is blatantly false. But beyond that, they've also done this somewhat covertly in Republican operatives working to elevate Kanye West and help him get on the ballot in states, which in of itself, too, is kind of a ridiculous premise. The assumption that because Kanye West is a rapper, African-Americans will want to vote for a rapper for president. And, you know, frankly, kind of shows a tone deafness. But we shouldn't be surprised by that. There are Americans who have complex views, and not all of them are driven by the same thing.
No, it's absolutely right. I mean, Simon Henschel, who wrote in advance, did ask the question, why do any people of color or women vote for Trump? I suppose, and this partly in response to Daniel on this, I suppose the assumption is that they think, people who've sent in these questions, that this person, Donald Trump, looks to them so obviously racist or misogynistic that they find it hard to believe racial minorities or women would vote for him. But Lauren, you and I have spoken particularly about the Latino vote and those areas you've been traveling in, I think, in your own home state of Arizona and picking up, talking to voters there. You know, obviously what Daniel says is right, that people are complicated and people don't vote in groups. But you, I think, picked up some more sort of specific and explanations for, I suppose, you know, particularly that phenomenon of Latino voters who are quite enthusiastic for Trump, not, as Daniel says, in majorities, but at least substantial minorities.
Yeah, Trump will not win the African-American vote, and he will not win the Latino vote, but he can succeed by just peeling off little pieces of that share from Joe Biden. And that's why he's doing this, and that's why he's investing, and he's got, you know, Spanish language ads running across the country in certain states. You know, to Daniel's point, especially when we're talking about the Hispanic community, you know, country of origin, generational, there's so many differences between, you know, Cubans in Florida are so different, as we talked about, the Mexican Americans in Arizona. You know, there's a couple things. There's a lot of, you know, faith, religion being sort of Christian, conservative, Catholic, that will persuade Latinos especially to vote for the Republican Party and even Donald Trump, similar to the way you see Christian conservatives and people wonder how can they support the president if they're, you know, these very pious conservative people. It's the same sort of logic. We're also seeing a really interesting gender gap. You're seeing that, you know, with white voters, with Black voters, and with Hispanic voters. And the Trump campaign has particularly targeted Hispanic men and African-American men. And that's because we see that these voters tend to prioritize the economy. That's an issue that men in general do tend to prioritize the economy and possibly over two other issues that tend to favor Democrats, which is healthcare, education. And so you see this gender gap, and the economy is the one issue where Trump really maintains the advantage over Biden. And so I think his campaign thinks it's worth it to try to target these voters, peel them away, even if maybe they just sit out. You know, that would be helpful to the Trump campaign.
Yeah, one of the mystifying things about this race has been how Trump has maintained a lead on who do voters trust more in handling the economy. Now, that lead, that margin has started to shrink. But throughout all of this, that's been the one area where the president has led Biden. And it's been very strange to me, you know, because we've gone through the beginnings of an economic recession, the painful impact of a global pandemic. But Trump has maintained that. And honestly, I think that's where the Trump campaign has really missed an opportunity. They were never able to capitalize on that. They were never able to turn this race, even for a day or a week, into a discussion over the economy and who is better, who would be better fit to handle that.
And what's your answer, Daniel, to your own question? Why do you think Trump has been able to retain a lead on economic handling, given the fact that the country has got huge unemployment numbers going into a coronavirus-related recession? What's your answer to your own question?
There's a long-standing knee-jerk reliance or trust in Republicans and sort of the idea of free market economics in this country. And it's not that surprising. It's easy. Republicans always have an easier time explaining the core tenets and the core philosophies on handling their economy. You know, cut taxes, free markets, let business handle it. And
I think you also do still hear, don't you, that he's a businessman and knows how to, run the economy. That does persist despite Richard dropping his jaw there for a moment.
Yeah, we've learned that that's not that. I mean, there's been libraries full of reporting about Trump's abilities as a businessman, and they are not what you would think. They don't measure up to even Mitt Romney, the last Republican nominee for president. A lot of voters are low information voters in this country, and they know Trump from his years on The Apprentice. They know he's a billionaire. It sinks in.
Let me get more questions, because people have been writing in. I mean, so many people are raising, and it suggests that maybe they're warriors like me. So many raise these questions of what if Trump doesn't accept the verdict? You know, somebody saying, what do we know about the attitude of Rosemary Lawrence? What do we know about the attitude of the military, and how critical could their support or lack of it be to the eventual outcome of the election? These are people who are imagining some kind of standoff. Milton Whaley says, should Joe Biden and the Democrats urge their voters to vote in person for this election? This is the fear that postal votes will be somehow discounted or tossed out en masse. Lots of people having this worry that somehow, you know, even if it all goes sort of to plan, Trump is going to cling on there and not leave office, and we could be into some standoff where he has to be sort of physically removed, you know, the Joint Chief of Staff coming in and ushering him out. Richard, I see you smiling about that. It's obviously not something that's keeping you up at night, but I bet you I can get you to agree on one thing, which is you wouldn't put money on Donald Trump coming out and giving a graceful concession speech and wishing President-elect Biden luck. You're not going to be betting on that on election night.
That's right. There's nothing that requires a candidate to even make a phone call to the other side, which is one of the hallowed traditions of American politics, never mind the concession speech. So yes, I think we can rule that out. Just in terms of the mechanics of what if he refuses to go. For a start, the United States military is not going to get involved in resolving an election. They know that anything that even hints of interference in an election, partisanship, it actually destroys their ability to suck up vast amounts of federal dollars from both parties, regardless of whether they're at war or peace. So they're just not going to do it. That's not the tradition. That's not what they're raised with as a culture. So I don't think that's going to happen. But if you really want to indulge the fantasy beyond one of your excellent books, Johnny, if you want to indulge the fantasy of escorting a president off the premises, the people who are actually responsible for the close proximity of the president are the Secret Service. And they, at this point, have very strict protocols that govern why they protect anyone. They're protecting the commander-in-chief and the chain around the commander-in-chief, and by extension, by Congress, former commanders-in-chief. But really, if you are the child of a former president, whether adult or actually infant, it doesn't matter anymore. So it's pretty brutal. When the Secret Service decides that you are no longer the commander-in-chief, that's it. There is a real and significant shift of power. And the idea that he could just sit and cross his legs in the Oval Office while the furniture is being ripped out, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think we're of the same mind on this. There's no tradition. There's no requirement that a president concedes. There are plenty of examples in recent electoral history statewide of candidates not conceding and just the system going on. It's really not a question of whether Trump himself accepts the election results. It's everyone else. Trump is not going to concede this election. It's just not going to happen. That is not him. He's stubborn, but that doesn't matter.
Why don't I put this to you, Lauren? I mean, I think that's right. He won't, but the important thing is the rest of the Republicans. Judging from what we've seen of the Republican Party, particularly in Congress, you know, should we be holding our breath for them to do the graceful thing and say, look, the American people have spoken and we wish President-elect Biden luck? Or can you imagine some of these Republican senators and congressmen saying, you know, well, it all looks, no one really knows what's happened. We'll have to wait and see, you know, to use a favorite Trumpian formulation.
Yeah, you shouldn't hold out for Senate Republicans to stand up to the president. That being said, we've seen in the last few weeks, a few senators, Republican senators, become more vocal in their criticism of the president as they start to worry about their own futures post-Trump. And I do think, you know, it does really depend on whether the result is very clear or if there's still these outstanding questions, because there are some scenarios where, you know, this could come down to legal wrangling in Wisconsin and, you know, there's electors there. We don't directly do a popular vote. And so there's so many points between Election Day and the Inauguration Day where mayhem could totally ensue. And like one scenario is Nancy Pelosi becoming the president. So there's a range of possibilities here. But I do think if the result is clear, at the risk of being very wrong again, I would expect some Republicans to step forward and say, this is the result. You know, we need a peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah. Just to bring in our closing 2 or 3 minutes, a final question or set of questions that have come in. Many, many people have asked variations of this, but let's go with the formulation from Richard Beach, who says, regardless of the outcome of the election, what can the next president do to bring American society together? And I'm going to put that to you, Richard Wolf, because you do the big picture column writing. I mean, this is a question that comes up in lots of forms there. The idea, and I think underneath it as well in some of the versions, is this notion that, all right, maybe Trump will lose and maybe Biden will beat Trump. But we've had 4 years of Trumpism, and that's left a lot of damage and been very polarizing and scarring these last 4 years. And I've sort of feel I'm detecting people thinking, OK, I'm allowing myself to imagine him winning, but maybe that won't be enough. What do you think?
I think that's a very real and lasting concern. You know, if you talk to people at the Lincoln Project, for instance, they will say that their effort is not just to defeat Trump, it's Trumpism. And I'm afraid that we're seeing the Republican Party move further to the right, where the QAnon conspiracy is now seen as the outer edges of the spectrum as opposed to Trumpism. So I do think there's a lasting challenge there. And the most recent example we have of people trying and failing to bring the country together was President Barack Obama. In 2009, he comes in, he puts Republicans in his cabinet, he goes in the stimulus negotiation in January to restart the economy and says to Republicans, look, take a third of this trillion dollars, $300 million, do with it what you like on tax cuts, spend it as you like. He still couldn't get any votes for it in the Senate. So I think the prospects of reuniting the country, even with someone who's an institutionalist and a moderate like Joe Biden, even with Republicans in his cabinet, are narrow and small, and it will take a very long time to recover domestically and internationally, I think, in terms of reestablishing the norms that have been destroyed over the last 4 years.
Huge thanks to Daniel Strauss, Lauren Gambino, and Richard Wolf for making that Guardian Live event such a success. There'll be another live event on November the 4th, when we may or may not know who the next president of the United States will be. I'll remind you of that nearer the time. I'll be back in your ears tomorrow morning with Richard Wolf as we stay up to watch tonight's presidential debate. How big a player will that mute button be? We'll have to wait and see. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Thanks so much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.